and from his nostrils, over his upper lip to his mouth.
Tell them I'm sorry.
Who?
Her parents.
Chapter 51. Angel Face.
The weeds reach as high as my knees. Nettles and creeping thistles, daisies and dandelions. My feet seem to be taking root like I'm just another unwatered plant caught between cracks in the broken concrete. Nobody has gone in or out of the Coach House Inn for the past 2 hours. Skirting the fence, I duck through a broken gate and approach the main doors. I'm holding a 2-foot length of steel pipe, which is hollow yet heavy, keeping it tucked under my arm. The keypad is covered by a plastic milk bottle cut to form a rain shield. My fingers punch out the code, and I nudge the door open, listening. I cross the foyer and follow the corridor, retracing my steps from the other night, feeling the stickiness of the carpet beneath my feet. The door to the lounge is open. There are beer bottles spread across the table and cigarettes crushed into ashtrays. I try to remember which room belonged to Felix. I look for a padlock. Find it. Kneeling before the door, I slip a Kirby grip from my hair and bend it back and forth until it breaks. This one is harder to pick than Jody's locker. My fingers grow sore and sticky with sweat. I wipe my hands and begin again, listening as I hold down the pins, being directed by the clicks. One more. One more. The lock falls open. The door swings inwards. The room is as I remember. The bed, the rumpled sheets, the soiled mattress, the camera on a tripod. Clothes are strewn across the floor. It reminds me of another room, in another house, where I lived with Terry's body, watching it bloat and discolour and leak. Swinging the metal pipe, I shatter the camera, sending shards of broken plastic and glass pinging off the walls like fists full of thrown gravel. The tripod buckles. I tear at the sheets and punch holes in the mattress and rip at the clothes. Breathing hard, I pause, looking at the destruction, feeling dissatisfied. How does this hurt him? Emptying my mind, I study the room, searching for hiding places. I'm good at this. Nobody is better. Dragging the mattress to the floor, I lever the metal pipe between the narrow horizontal slats, tearing out nails and splintering the wood, exposing the floor beneath. Crawling inside the bed base, I tap at the skirting board, listening for a hollow echo. Silverfish, dead and living, tumble or scurry as I search the carpet for signs of wear or concealment. Nothing. I start again, walking up and down the room, taking small steps. The floor creaks under my right foot. Dropping to my knees, I peel back the carpet, revealing a loose sheet of plywood that covers a gap between the beams. Lifting the board away, I discover a shoebox. Inside the shoebox is a package, double-wrapped in tape. I tear open one corner with my teeth and recognize the contents. Crystals, ice, meth. There's something else wrapped in an oily black rag, heavy in my hand. A pistol, with a long, narrow barrel and brown polymer handle. It looks old, like it should be in a museum. I test a button, and a compartment slides from the handle into my other palm. Bullets are pressed inside, one on top of the other. I've held a gun before. Terry had one. He used to clean it on the kitchen table, taking it apart like a puzzle and wiping down each part with solvent and oil, using a cut-up t-shirt and a brass rod for the barrel. One day, he grabbed my wrist and made me pick it up. I didn't want to touch it.
"Go on," he said. "Feel how heavy it is."
I took the gun in both hands.
"Put your finger on the trigger."
I did as he asked.
"Point it at me."
"No."
"Aim it just here."
He tapped the center of his chest. "No."
"Point the fucking gun. I'm a bad man, remember?"
I shook my head.
Do it. Now. Pull the trigger.
My hands were trembling. Terry sighed in disgust and took the pistol from me.
There's no bullet in the chamber, you idiot.
He showed me how to release the magazine and rack the slide and clear the chamber.
Next time I tell you to shoot, you better follow my fucking orders.
I rewrapped the pistol in the rag and tucked the bundle into the waistband of my jeans, where it rests against the small of my back. Then I replaced the empty shoebox and the plywood and the carpet before taking the package of drugs to the bathroom, where I rip it open, spilling crystals into the toilet bowl. Most of them sink, while others float on top like soapy scum. I flush. Water swirls and disappears. I flush again. Bye-bye. Voices. They're here. Edging across the floor, I press my cheek against the door. Keely, Tuba, Felix. They're in the hallway, getting closer.
What time is the memorial?
Asks Tuba.
3 o'clock.
I left the padlock lying on the floor. What if Felix looks down? If he sees... They're passing, turning into the lounge. Edging the door open a crack, I look across the hallway and see Tuba unpacking beers and putting them in the cooler box. Felix is wearing a coat and tie. His hair is oiled. I want to stay hidden. I want to curl up and wait them out. But if Felix sees the padlock, I'm going to die. You have a gun. He'll take it from me. Not if you shoot him first. Felix lights a cigarette and tosses the lighter onto the table, resting the ashtray on his stomach and tilting his head back. Tuba puts on some music. They're arguing over whether British rap is better than American rap. This is my chance. Unwrapping the pistol, I hold it against my chest and slip out of the room into the empty corridor. Quickly, quietly, I pass in front of the lounge, momentarily glimpsing Felix lounging on the sofa. He doesn't see me. I keep moving, eyes ahead. The floor creaks, and Keely steps out of a room, looking at the screen of her phone. I freeze, holding the pose as though we're playing a game of musical statues. She lifts her eyes and opens her mouth. I lunge and grab her hair, yanking her to the ground and covering her mouth with my other hand. Not a word, I whisper. Not a word. I close my teeth around her earlobe, feeling the back of a silver stud scratching at my tongue. Keely whimpers. I show her the gun, pressing the muzzle against her forehead and holding one finger upright against her lips. Not a fucking word. Keely cowers. I get to my feet and walk backwards until I reach the foyer, then the main doors and the steps and the parking area and the road outside. Finally, I run, holding the gun inside my sweatshirt.
Chapter 52. The incident room is slowly being dismantled. Shredded paper spills from bins, and the whiteboards have been picked clean of photographs and maps. The bulk of the task force has been reassigned, but a few remaining souls are typing out statements and tying up loose ends. Lenny's office is full of half-packed boxes and empty filing cabinets. I haven't had a chance to talk to her about her transfer and whether she's seriously considering retirement. She's too good at her job to walk away, but too poor at the politics to change direction.
I have another week to wrap up the Jodie Sheehan investigation, she says,
putting another box file in a carton.
Once I turn over the brief to the CPS, the lawyers take over.
What if Farley's confession is disallowed?
Won't matter. We have DNA, fibres, and dog hairs. Those things are better than a signed confession. People might not believe in God, or ghosts, or man-made climate change, but they believe in forensic evidence.
I move a box from a chair and sit down. I talk to Farley. He heard Jodie being thrown off the footbridge.
Let it go, Cyrus.
Tasman didn't leave the patio door unlocked. Jodie couldn't get inside. That's why she walked home. Lenny reads another label on a file. Behind her, Antonia appears in the doorway.
Dr. Ness wants a word. Patch him through, says Lenny. He's waiting outside.
Lenny glances at me, raising an eyebrow. The chief pathologist rarely ventures outside the morgue, unless it's to a crime scene or the golf course. Stepping around Antonia, Ness smiles apologetically, his eyes bright and his tightly curled hair looking like a furry helmet. He gives Lenny's office a quick once-over, as though he might be in the market for one just like it, before taking a seat next to me and pulling off his soft leather gloves, one finger at a time.
There's been a development, he says. The DNA report on Jodie Sheehan's unborn child was emailed through from the lab in Boston this morning. It closely matches the traces of semen found on her thigh and indicates that the father was someone close to her.
Lenny frowns.
When you say close to her?
He shares runs of homozygosity.
Runs of what?
He's family, I say, understanding a little more of the science. Lenny looks from Ness to me.
Which one?
Ness gives us both a quick lesson on chromosomes and DNA.
When children are born from incest, their genomes show an absence of heterozygosity because their DNA contains large chunks where the mother and father's contribution are identical because they already share much of the same genetic code. These are called runs of homozygosity. The more chunks of the child's DNA where the mother and father's contribution are identical, the more likely it is that they're first-degree relatives.
Okay, so who are we looking for?
Asks Lenny. Ness won't be rushed.
A brother and sister share 50% DNA. If they had a baby, it would likely share roughly 25%. It's the same if father and daughter incest leads to pregnancy. An uncle and niece share 25% DNA, and their offspring would have 12.5%. The figures are the same for half-siblings. First cousins share about 12.5%, but any offspring would have less than this. These figures aren't absolutes, but a Y chromosome match with the blood relative can confirm the incest.
Lenny is growing impatient.
Who impregnated Jodie?
Ness blinks at her, before realising that he's only told us half of the story.
The fetal sample showed a commonality of 12.5%. So you're looking at the uncle, Brian Whittaker. Like I said, you'll need to test him to be absolutely sure, but unless she has another uncle...
I glance at Lenny. Her fists are clenched, bloodless.
He was home that night, I say. Jodie could have confronted him. Threatened him with blackmail.
Lenny grabs her coat from a hook on the wall and opens the door, yelling,
Antonia, I want a car, now!
We're moving. Lenny projects her voice across the incident room.
Edgar, you're with me. Monroe, get me a search warrant for the Whittaker house and car. I want everything we have on Brian Whittaker. Sexual complaints, rumours, whispers. We need his phone records and internet search history.
I'm in the corridor with Lenny ahead of me. Ness has been left behind. Lenny looks over her shoulder.
Where do I find Whittaker?
He'll be at the memorial service.
Chapter 53. Brian Whittaker is arrested in the parking area of the Corpus Christi Catholic Church as the memorial service ends. Mourners are slowly filtering through the doors, many of them dressed in yellow hats and scarves or carrying yellow balloons. Lenny dispenses with the handcuffs and offers Whittaker a phone call, which he uses to call his wife rather than a lawyer, a poor decision. Felicity is still inside, comforting Maggie, or shielding her from sympathisers and reporters.
I don't understand what this is about,
Whittaker says from the rear seat of the police car.
What am I supposed to have done?
You've been read your rights, replies Lenny.
What am I being charged with? Aren't you supposed to tell me?
You've been arrested on suspicion of murder.
That's ridiculous.
Lenny ignores his subsequent questions and protests, but lets him keep talking, enjoying his frustration. We're nearing the police station when she turns and looks over her shoulder from the front seat.
Are you a religious man, Brian?
He doesn't answer.
There's a passage in the Bible, the Gospel of Matthew, if memory serves. If anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble, it would be better for them to have a large millstone hung around their neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea.
I would never hurt a child.
You love them, I know. All the nonces say that.
Whitaker's face alters, twisting out of shape, and his fists clench and unclench. Lenny doesn't press the issue. Instead, she puts him in an interview room at West Bridgeford Police Station and lets him marinate for a few hours in a toxic slurry of fear and uncertainty. In the meantime, a search warrant is issued for his house, where laptops, tablets, and mobile phones are seized. Felicity Whitaker is brought to the station, entering through a rear door. Although she's not under arrest, everything about her body language seems to be weighted down like she's a deep-sea diver wearing leaden boots, walking along the ocean floor.
Can I get you something?
I ask, as she waits to be questioned in a comfort room normally set aside for sexual assault victims.
No, thank you.
I bring her a cup of tea anyway. She leaves the tea bag dangling inside as she holds it with both hands to keep it steady.
How long will this take?
She asks. I don't know. She's nursing a leather handbag, touching it occasionally like she's petting a cat. Do you want to be left alone? I ask.
No, stay.
She sips her tea.
I've never been to a police station. I mean, I've seen them on TV. I used to love The Bill and Inspector George Gently. Crime dramas, you know. I like a good detective story.
Are you very good at picking the villain?
Hopeless. Half the time they don't give us a chance, do they? They make it someone so unlikely.
Her hands are shaking.
I'm sorry Brian shouted at you. You didn't mean to be rude. What's this about?
Jodie was pregnant.
Yes, I know. But what's that got to do with Brian?
On the night she went missing, did Brian go to the fireworks with you?
No. He had an AA meeting at the Methodist Church in Sherwood. He goes every week. He's been sober for nearly 9 years.
Was he a bad drunk?
He never took it out on the kids.
What about you? She sighs.
We've been married a long time. Some arguments are worse than others.
What time did you get home that night?
9:30. I was a bit tipsy. Maggie kept filling my glass with champagne.
Did you see Brian?
I heard him come home. I was in bed.
What did you hear?
The front door, keys on the table, the shower running.
Did he get up during the night? Felicity looks at the teabag, which is solidifying in the bottom of her mug.
We don't sleep in the same room. Not since.
She shakes her head.
You can't really believe that Brian had sex with Jodie.
The DNA tests on her unborn child show she was carrying his baby. Felicity stares at me, as though waiting for a different punchline. Then she shakes her head from side to side, gasping.
Oh God, what will Maggie say? She'll never forgive me.
It's not your fault.
He's my husband.
Lenny carries a pile of printouts and folders into the interview room, putting them on the table in front of Brian Whitaker. It's part of the theatre, a prop to unnerve the suspect. Right now, he's wondering how he could have generated so much paperwork in such a short time. Opening a folder, Lenny turns several pages, silently reading the contents while Edgar pulls up a seat and checks the recording equipment, announcing their names, along with the time, date, and location.
How long have you been married, Brian?
Asks Lenny. 22 years.
That's a fair innings. Do you still look into your wife's eyes when you tell her that you love her?
Leave my wife out of this.
I'll take that as a no, says Lenny.
I doubt if there's a single drop of passion left after that long, although I'm sure you can pretend. You can close your eyes. You can imagine you're with someone else.
Tell us about Bonnie Dowling.
Understanding seems to blossom behind Whittaker's eyes.
She made a vexatious complaint.
Vexatious? That's a big word. A lawyer's word. You took photographs of her in the showers.
No.
You walked in on her.
That was an accident.
Why would she lie?
Her father owed me coaching fees. £400. He wouldn't pay up. I threatened to sue him. Next thing, he's accusing me of being a pervert.
But you ended up paying him.
I waived his fees. I should have sued him for slander.
That sounds plausible, says Lenny. But it seems odd that your phone was stolen before the police can investigate the complaint. I can't work out if that's convenient or unfortunate.
There were no photographs, says Whittaker. It was bullshit.
Watching him through the observation window, I can see him fortifying himself, but he's less confident than before.
When did you start coaching Jodie?
Asks Edgar.
I've always coached her.
When did you start grooming her?
That's a lie.
Your fingerprints were found on condoms in her school locker, says Lenny.
The statement rattles his composure.
I bought them for her when I discovered she was sexually active. I didn't want her falling pregnant.
That's very avuncular of you. Did Jodie's parents know you were buying her condoms?
Of course not.
Did Jodie ask you to?
No.
How did you discover she was sexually active?
I guessed. I feared. I've had it happen before. Young skaters reach a certain age. They think they're missing out, or they go boy crazy.
You must see how it looks, Brian. You're her uncle, her skating coach, and you're buying her condoms. You're facilitating her having underage sex. Did you take her virginity?
Don't be ridiculous.
I can see how it could happen. You're travelling together to competitions, sharing a room to save money, separate beds to begin with. Then one night...
Whittaker is breathing heavily through his nostrils, while his eyes are screwing a hole through Lenny's forehead.
You're wrong!
You got her pregnant, Brian.
No!
We found the search history on your laptop. You were looking up abortion clinics.
I wanted to help her.
By lying to us?
No! I mean, Jodie came to me. She told me she was pregnant. I thought, because of her skating career and her age, I mean, she was too young to have a baby. Jodie couldn't talk to her parents. Maggie is so devoutly Catholic, and Dougal would have gone to war. I thought if we could do it quietly, without anyone knowing...
It was your suggestion.
Jodie agreed.
But she changed her mind.
Whittaker doesn't answer.
We've done the DNA tests, Brian. We know you're the father.
What? No!
It doesn't matter if Jodie consented. You were in a position of trust, and she was a minor. In a few hours from now, technicians will have triangulated the signals from Jodie's phone, pinpointing her movements in her last hours. They're going to put you and Jodie together on the night she died. I think you had sex with her, and afterwards you followed her. You begged her to have an abortion, but she wouldn't listen. She threatened everything. Your career, your marriage, your reputation. You hit her from behind and dumped her off the bridge. You left Jodie for dead. And that's what happened. She died cold and alone in that clearing.
No,
he moans. His chest is bent forward towards his knees, and his forehead almost touches the table. Opening a different folder, Lenny begins pulling out crime scene photographs, laying them down one by one.
Don't look away, Brian. See what you did.
Whittaker blinks at her wordlessly. The deep lines around his eyes are etched in misery.
I didn't. I wouldn't. Ask Felicity.
We've spoken to your wife. She didn't see you come in that night.
I was there. I came home. I had a shower. I went to bed.
You sleep in different rooms.
I didn't go out again.
Lenny sighs and collects the photographs.
You can keep telling that story all the way to your trial, but eventually a jury is going to see right through your fabrications and bluster.
You caught the guy. You charged him.
Craig Farley is guilty of many things, but he didn't get Jodie pregnant. He didn't hit her from behind or push her off a bridge.
Dropping his head into his hands, Whittaker groans.
This is wrong. A mistake. Let me talk to Felicity. Let me explain.
Chapter 54. Three words appear on my pager. Poppy has gone. I call Evie's mobile, and she answers breathlessly, unable to get the words out quickly enough.
There's a hole under the fence, near the gate. I found her collar hanging on the chain. I've looked everywhere.
I tell her to calm down. She won't go far.
What if she gets run over? What if someone took her?
We'll find her. Minutes later, I'm behind the wheel. Each time I catch myself driving too quickly, I reluctantly touch the brakes, cursing the amount of traffic. Why is every Sunday driver out today? Every little old lady, slow truck, Belgian, Audi owner, and lawn bowler. I don't want to imagine losing Poppy. Not because I've grown attached to her, but because of Evie. I should never have got her a dog. The downside risk was too great. She hasn't loved anything or anyone in so long, and now I've opened her up to being hurt again, abandoned. Pulling up outside the house, I see Evie standing on the brick wall, yelling Poppy's name. Her arms are wrapped around her body, hugging her chest, shaking. She tells me again about the collar and the fence, and how she's knocked on doors and talked to neighbours. I know how hard that must be for Evie, meeting strangers and interacting with people.
We should make posters, I say, wanting to keep her occupied. Do you have a photograph?
She holds up her phone. Okay, download them onto my laptop and make a poster and flyers. We'll put them up on lampposts and in mailboxes. Upstairs, I begin getting changed, pulling on a t-shirt, compression leggings and a fleece-lined top. I have to wear my old running shoes, which are almost worn through.
Where are you going?
Evie asks.
I can cover more ground.
What will I do?
You put up the posters.
She shows me an A4 page with a photograph of Poppy taken in the garden and the headline, Missing Dog. Underneath is a description of Poppy and Evie's phone number, along with the words, Reward offered.
What reward? I ask.
We'll think of something,
she says, hopefully. We decide on a plan. I'll cover the park and run along Woolerton Road, while Evie knocks on doors and distributes the flyers. Setting off, I jog my usual route along Parkside before turning through the entrance to Woolerton Park. I soon grow breathless, trying to run and call Poppy's name at the same time. Occasionally, I stop and ask people if they've seen her, showing them Evie's poster, which is damp with my sweat. I carry on running, calling, asking. Having circled the park, I cross Derby Road and search the grounds of the university, past the boating lake and the faculty buildings. Nottingham is suddenly a maze. Poppy could be anywhere, sleeping under a hedge or in someone's garden. She could be miles away by now, or I could run right past her and never know. They say there are only four human emotions, and sadness is one of them. But there are different types of sadness. Loss, failure, abandonment, depression. Some of these are unavoidable. Some are necessary. Some make us human and whole. I remember seeing a Michael Lunig cartoon showing a tiny, sad-eyed man with a noose around his neck. The rope was curled over a beam with a large bucket tied to the other end. As the man cried, his tears filled the bucket and lifted him higher and higher off the ground. Evie is that figure, standing on her tiptoes, filling a bucket with her tears. If only she could stop crying. It's growing dark. I'm exhausted. I cannot run or stumble any further. With dread in every step, I turn for home, trying to fashion words for Evie. As I turn the corner, I see her waving from the gate, yelling.
She's home! She's home!
A wave of relief breaks over me, rushing over the shingles with a soft, rattling hush that whispers, "Thank God." Chapter 55. Angel Face.
"I knew you'd come,"
the woman had announced. I had been about to put a flyer through the mailbox when the door swung open and she said,
"Labrador, golden coloured. What's her name?"
"Poppy."
"Come, come, she's in the garden."
She ushered me along the hallway and through patio doors to a small, neat garden with paving stones and raised flowerbeds. Poppy was tethered to a wheelbarrow full of ornamental plants.
"She didn't have a collar, but I knew she belonged to someone. She's such a beautiful girl."
Short and dumpy, with a pudding bowl haircut, the woman had a yappy dog in her arms and two cocker spaniels leaping around her legs. I threw myself at Poppy, burying my face in her neck, squeezing her so hard that she whimpered, but she kept wagging her tail.
"We were in the park, and Poppy came bounding over and started playing with Ajax and John Brown,"
the woman said.
"They were having such fun. I kept looking for her owner, but nobody showed up. Poppy followed us home and sat at the front door. Eventually I brought her inside. I knew you'd come looking."
The lump in my throat made it hard for me to answer. It's still there now as I tell the story to Cyrus, who is unlacing his running shoes and looking at a blister on his heel. Meanwhile, Poppy is curled up on a rug in the laundry, oblivious to the trouble she's caused. "I promised her a reward," I say.
"Do you think she expects money?"
"We could take her flowers."
"Good idea."
"I saw a nice garden a few doors down."
"We're not stealing flowers."
"Okay, right." The blister looks really nasty. I've tightened Poppy's collar so it won't slip off, but there's still a hole under the back fence, so we can't let her go outside.
"I'll fix it,"
says Cyrus, retying his runners.
"You don't have to do it now."
"I should."
Cyrus collects a metal toolbox from beneath the stairs and walks outside to the garden shed. After a few minutes, he emerges with a sawhorse under his right arm and several wooden planks balanced on his opposite shoulder. He kneels and examines the hole beneath the fence. Some of the palings have rotted where they were partially buried in the ground, breaking easily in his fingers. He kneels and begins scooping out soil.
"Can I help?" I ask.
Cyrus hands me a torch and peels off his sweaty t-shirt, tossing it onto the steps. Then he takes out a tape measure and calculates the dimensions of the gap. I notice his tattoos. The inked birds on his torso and arms look like mythical creatures that shimmer in the torchlight, transforming into new shapes as he moves his arms and bends his body, measuring wood and marking it up. He tucks the pencil behind his ear and picks up a handsaw, which he draws back and forth along the line with a strong, easy rhythm, creating puffs of sawdust that fall onto the grass like tiny flakes of snow.
"Where did you learn to do that?" I ask.
"My father taught me. These were his tools."
I look at the folding drawers of the toolbox, full of chisels and screwdrivers with worn wooden handles. There is a small axe. Momentarily, I contemplate what happened to Cyrus's family before pushing the thought away. Cyrus kneels again and measures the piece of wood against the hole. I try not to look at the cabled veins and muscles on his back. The tattooed wings are so beautifully drawn, I have to fight the urge to reach out and touch them with my fingertips, to stroke the feathers, feeling their softness.
"Light, please."
"Huh?"
"The torch?"
"Oh, sorry."
I focus the light on Cyrus's hands as he measures another length of wood and begins sawing. When he straightens, I notice the downy line of dark hair beneath his navel and the slight shadow where the waistband of his running leggings is stretched across his hip bones. Are you cold? I ask. I can get you a sweater.
I'm okay,
he replies. What about a cup of tea?
I'd prefer a beer.
I go inside and glimpse him through the kitchen window, telling myself to stop being so foolish. Getting two bottles of Heineken from the fridge, I open them and return to the garden. Cyrus takes the beer and empties it in one long series of swallows. He notices that I have one too.
Is that for me?
He asks. I mumble and thrust the bottle towards him. He smiles and says,
No, you have it,
before turning back to the repairs. I'm aiming the torch, but my eyes stray again. This time I'm looking at his mouth and wondering what it would be like to kiss those lips, the upper one thinner and shaped like a cupid's bow, the lower one fuller and pinker. How would it feel to touch his teeth with my tongue? Don't be stupid. Foolish girl. I am not a sexual being or a sensual one. I don't crave physical contact or need sexual release. Yet, I feel strange around Cyrus. Different. Light spills across the grass from the open door, a golden glow with slashes of purple where the shadows are deepest. Cyrus has stopped speaking. He's looking up, waiting for me to say something, but I haven't been paying attention. Has he asked me a question? He brushes dirt from his knees.
Are you okay, Evie?
What?
I asked what you wanted for dinner.
Oh.
The pub on the corner does a good steak. The fillet is this thick.
He holds his thumb and forefinger an inch apart. I'm a vegetarian.
They have other things.
That'd be nice, I whisper.
Chapter 56. Evie has pinned back her hair, letting a few carefully arranged locks fall across her cheeks, framing her face. She's wearing mascara and eyeshadow, making her eyes look enormous and her skin impossibly pale. I prefer it when she's scrubbed clean of blandishments, and I can see her freckles when she looks her age. We find a table in the restaurant area, away from the busy front bar where people are watching a European Cup match on the TV, groaning or cheering at the ebb and flow of the action. Evie is mirroring my movements, unfolding her serviette, putting it on her lap, reading the menu. At times like this, she doesn't seem like a damaged teenager. She is confident and articulate and trying to be normal. Practicing. Our relationship has already crossed boundaries in professional terms because of the emotion that comes with therapy. When you hire a lawyer, it doesn't matter if he or she believes in your innocence or if you like spending time with them. The same is true of a surgeon. As long as they do a good job, your personal feelings don't matter. With a psychologist, it's different because it involves observation and trust and engagement and empathy. I am walking a tightrope when it comes to Evie because I'm not sure if I can be everything she needs. A guardian, a therapist, a friend, and a confidant. She has a gift. She calls it a curse. Perhaps she's right. Perhaps she'll never lead a normal life. But I can try to protect her. If others discover what Evie can do, they'll never let her go. Guthrie was right about that much. The questions, experiments, and clinical trials will never stop. Evie will become a guinea pig, a lab rat, a freak, a weapon. I will not let that happen. The restaurant is short-staffed, and the lone waitress is chatting to two young guys at the bar. I wave. She ignores me. One of the young men glances at Evie, trying to make eye contact. She seems oblivious. I signal to the waitress again. Nothing. Evie gets up and weaves between tables, interposing herself between the waitress and the two men.
Sorry if I'm interrupting your planning for tonight's threesome, but we're waiting to order?
Heads turn. The waitress looks horrified. The men laugh. Evie jabs one of them in the chest with the knuckle of her forefinger.
If you don't stop staring at me, I'll shove that glass in your face.
His smile evaporates, and he steps back, no longer certain of anything. Returning to the table, Evie sips from her glass of water, acting as though nothing has happened.
You didn't have to do that, I say.
Do what?
Embarrass people.
He was staring at me.
He was admiring you.
What?
You look nice tonight.
Evie screws up her nose, embarrassed by the compliment. She doesn't understand praise because it heightens expectations. She thinks I don't mean it, or that I should be praising someone else.
The waitress arrives, glancing at Evie nervously.
I'll have a rum and coke, says Evie, and a mushroom risotto.
I order the fillet steak, medium rare, with a peppercorn sauce on the side. We share a salad. Waiting for our meals to arrive, Evie picks up her drink and leans back in her chair. She holds the glass to her lips, studying me over the rim.
Any thoughts on what you might like to do? I say, making conversation.
Evie considers this for a bit, giving the question a sense of gravity.
I could work with animals.
You mean like a veterinary assistant?
Or a dog walker. I saw one today. She had 6 dogs in the park and a van with the company logo on the side.
You don't have a driving license.
I know.
We could apply for a provisional one.
Her face brightens.
Really?
All we need is a birth certificate or a passport.
I don't have anything like that.
But the court gave you a new identity.
Without papers.
This information surprises me, but Evie seems resigned to the fact. It's another reminder that she has no official past beyond a secret room in a murder house. Most people belong somewhere. They have a family, a school, a neighbourhood, and a country. They share interests, join groups, support teams, vote for parties, and form tribes. Evie has none of this.
I'll see what I can do about getting you a license, I say, not sure of who I can call. Maybe Caroline Fairfax can help.
We've almost finished eating when my pager beeps and Lenny's number appears on screen. I call her from a payphone near the cigarette machine.
Brian Whittaker didn't break, she says, but we'll have another crack at him in the morning. Sex with a minor is worth 2 years, but I want him for more than that.
I hear loud music in the background. She pauses for a moment, telling someone to turn the volume down. She's back.
The boffins managed to isolate Jodie Sheehan's burner phone. It was purchased a month ago as a job lot of 6 phones from an eBay seller. The signal puts Jodie at the fireworks and the fish and chip shop and Jimmy Verbich's party.
How long did she stay?
15 minutes, give or take. Most likely she was delivering drugs for Felix, but I'm leaving that out of my report.
Does Verbich frighten you that much?
Yes,
she says, bluntly.
There were 200 guests, and for all we know, one of them was the chief constable.
I can see her point.
Where did Jodie go when she left Verbich's place?
The signal shows she walked to Old Market Square and caught the 10 o'clock tram towards Clifton South. She got off the tram at Ruddington Lane, probably heading for the Whittaker House, which is 10 minutes away. She used the pedestrian underpass beneath the A52 and walked along Somerton Avenue.
What time was that?
11:15.
Tasman Whittaker said Jodie didn't arrive.
According to the signal, Jodie spent nearly 3 hours at the house, which puts Brian Whittaker on the hook. Her phone stopped transmitting just before 2 a.m.
Where?
Best approximation? On the footbridge.
The facts are starting to fit the timeline. Whittaker came home from his AA meeting and found Jodie at the house, or had arranged to meet her there. They had sex. Maybe she tried to blackmail him. They argued. He followed her. She finished up dead. Evie is waiting for me at the table, where the bill is sitting on a saucer with a single mint. Evie is sucking on the other one. I open my wallet and take out my card.
Thank you,
she says, rubbing a lock of hair between her forefinger and thumb.
My pleasure.
I'll find a way to repay you.
You don't have to. We take our coats from hooks beside the stairs and get a blast of frigid air as we step outside. A clear day means a cold night. Evie puts her arm through mine. It feels self-conscious, as though she's unsure how I'll react. Our hips and shoulders bump together as we walk.
What is Claire like?
Nice, I say, feeling the tameness of the word.
Is she pretty?
Yes.
She must be very smart to be a lawyer.
Yes, she is.
Do you miss her?
Sometimes.
Do you think you'll get married?
I don't know if we're still together.
Not to her, necessarily. To someone else.
Maybe. Evie tries to walk on her toes, putting one foot in front of the other, like a catwalk model. Reaching the house, I unlock the front door, standing back to let her pass me. Suddenly, she pushes herself against me in a reckless hug. My whole body stiffens. Undeterred, Evie kisses me. It's not so much a kiss as a wrestling hold or a spin-the-bottle attempt by someone who has practiced for hours on the back of her hand. I push her away. She tries again. This time I'm firmer, shoving her hard, holding her at arm's length.
Don't do that!
I snap. The colour drains from her face.
What's got into you?
You think I'm ugly?
No.
I'm damaged goods.
Of course not.
Bullshit.
Look at me, Evie. Ask the question again.
Do you think I'm damaged goods?
No.
Do you think I'm ugly?
No.
She believes me now.
Why then?
She asks.
It's unprofessional.
You're not my shrink.
I'm your guardian.
I won't tell anyone.
It can't happen, Evie.
How long do I have to wait?
It's not a matter of time. It's never going to happen. Ever.
Evie studies my face and sees that I'm telling the truth. It makes her angry, embarrassed, humiliated. I should have seen this coming. I did. I feared her physical proximity and how my actions could be misinterpreted or misconstrued. Evie has been lost in the system for years, labelled a management problem to be controlled, not listened to. Then I come along, someone who doesn't make demands or rush to judgment or punish her for mistakes. If anything, I've rewarded her worst behaviour because I know where it comes from. This must be enormously attractive to someone like Evie. We're still on the doorstep. Every fibre of her seems ready to flee, or fight, or have the ground swallow her up. She slaps me hard across the face.
What was that for?
Nothing. I'm sorry. You can hit me back.
She braces herself.
No.
Please.
No.
Chapter 57. Angel Face.
Foolish girl. Stupid girl. My hand is stinging from the slap, and Cyrus has finger marks on his cheek, outlined in white, as if my hand had been covered in chalk dust when I hit him. I rock from foot to foot, unable to look in his eyes, frightened of what I might see. He turned cold the moment I kissed him. He didn't want to touch me. Not my face. Not my mouth. Not my body. Of course not. Other men have touched me and kissed me and done things that didn't feel right. I thought that if I did it with someone like Cyrus, it would feel different. It wouldn't be wicked. It wouldn't be wrong. I'll get you some ice, I say.
No, I'm fine.
I keep messing things up.
We won't mention it again.
Why doesn't he get angry? Why won't he hit me? He hasn't shut the door. Are you leaving? I ask.
Just for a while.
Because of me?
No. The police have tracked Jodie Sheehan's last movements. I thought I might retrace her steps.
Can I come?
It's a tram ride, nothing exciting.
I want to. Cyrus hesitates. Please let me come. Please let me come. He nods. I breathe again and say, I'm sorry about before.
Before?
The kiss.
What kiss?
An Uber drops us in central Nottingham, opposite a grand Victorian house that looks like it's made from white marzipan. Mist has turned the streetlights into fuzzy yellow balls that seem to be suspended from invisible strings. I've been quiet on my journey, still angry with myself. What was I thinking? He's not handsome. He's one of them. The white coats. A shrink. Ugh! We're standing on the side of the road, wrapped up against the cold. What was Jodie doing here? I ask. Cyrus nods into the darkness.
She went to a party up the road.
I recognise a half-truth. Was she delivering for Felix? He doesn't answer. He doesn't have to. We're walking down Regent Street, retracing Jodie's steps. Occasionally I have to skip or add an extra step to keep up with him. As we near the centre of the city, there are more people spilling out of pubs, bars, restaurants and fast food places that smell of piri-piri chicken, hamburgers, pizzas and kebabs. We pass the city library and cross Old Market Square to the tram stop in the shadow of the council house. A dozen people are waiting, some of them drunk, others kissing, a few studying their phones.
She caught the next one,
says Cyrus, checking the time. He buys tickets from a machine. 5 minutes pass, and a modern-looking tram ghosts quietly into view, pulling up at the platform. We sit near the front, side by side. I'm not sure if I should talk, or if Cyrus needs quiet to concentrate. When he's thinking, his brow furrows, and his eyes take on the colour of green sea glass, as though he's searching for an idea, or listening to a distant, unseen object that is broadcasting information to him. The tram heads east along Cheapside and turns south when it reaches Weekday Cross. I know some of these places from day trips away from Langford Hall. They have cameras, I say, pointing above the driver's head. Do you think someone followed her?
Maybe.
I pull my feet up and wrap my arms around my shins. Did you know your brother was sick? I ask. When he killed your family, I mean.
He'd been on medication since he was 16.
Do you blame him for what happened?
No.
I say, making it clear I don't believe him. Where is Elias now?
A place called Rampton. It's a secure psychiatric hospital, about an hour north of here.
Do you ever visit him?
Yes.
He's lying, but not completely.
The last time I visited, Elias caused a scene because I didn't bring him any jelly babies.
Jelly babies?
They're his favourite, but visitors aren't allowed to bring in food.
What happened to him after the murders?
He pleaded guilty to manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility.
Does that mean he can get out one day?
I suppose it does.
Is that why you became a psychologist?
People assume that.
What do you say?
I avoid self-analysis.
That's another lie.
My grandparents wanted me to be a surgeon, but I chose psychology because it was the most difficult thing I could imagine doing.
Why?
Surgery has rules. The problems are tangible and technical, whereas psychology relies more on instinct than empathy. A surgeon can see his or her results and knows all the answers after the operation. He can declare a decision right or wrong, looking forwards and understanding backwards, which is how we all live. A psychologist has no such certainty. I cannot reach inside a brain and rearrange things. I cannot search for holes with my fingertips or
repair damage with sutures and clamps. Yet, that's what I have to do. Fix holes, paper over cracks, mend and compensate. I have to repair what's broken using words and ideas and thoughts.
You want to heal the world, I say.
Or to save myself?
The answer is too glib, too neat. I think you don't want to visit your brother, I say. You don't want to look into his eyes and remember what he did. And it doesn't matter how many times you remind yourself that he's your brother and you should love him. It doesn't change how you feel.
Cyrus looks sad rather than angry. I wish you wouldn't do that.
What?
That.
The tram has been moving quietly between stops, and the carriage has slowly emptied. It crossed a river and skirted a pond before the track straightened for a long stretch.
This is us,
says Cyrus, as it slows again. Ruddington Lane has an uncovered platform bathed in a pale yellow glow from trackside lights.
This way,
says Cyrus. We follow a concrete footpath, past rows of neat semi-detached houses and cottages, most of which are dark except for security lights that trigger as we pass, or the occasional grey flickering of a TV behind the curtains. Do you know who got Jodie pregnant? I ask.
Her uncle.
Did he rape her?
We don't know.
What about Craig Farley?
I think he found Jodie's body.
Alive?
Close to death.
I make a umph sound through my nostrils. And people say I'm screwed up.
Chapter 58. The Whittaker's house is dark, except for a light upstairs behind a glowing square blind. I know the layout of these post-war bungalows. Three bedrooms and one bathroom on the upper floor, with a narrow staircase that partially doubles back on itself. The ground floor has an entrance hall, sitting room, kitchen, laundry, and a dining area overlooking a patio and rear garden. I try to picture Jodie arriving here that night. Smoke from bonfires and the smell of gunpowder must have lingered in the air. Jodie didn't have a key, I say out loud. Tasmin had promised to leave the patio door unlocked.
Did she?
Asks Evie. No, she wanted to punish Jodie for keeping secrets.
Is that why she walked home?
According to the phone signals, Jodie spent 3 hours here. She must have knocked on the door or found another way inside. Perhaps Brian Whittaker let her into the house. I glance along the side path to a small silver caravan. Aidan told the police he was home that night, but that he didn't see Jodie. Surely he'd have a key to the house. Headlights swing around the corner towards us, bleaching our faces white. Evie instinctively raises her hand to shield her eyes. I recognise the distinctive silhouette of a black cab. Dougal Sheehan doesn't seem to notice us as he brakes hard and flings open the driver's door. Moments later, he's hammering his fist on the front door and holding down a plastic button that chimes through the house. Nobody answers. He grunts disgustedly and leaps over the low hedge before jogging down the side path towards the caravan.
Aidan!
He yells.
Are you in there?
He tries the handle. It's locked. He tries to break it off, but fails. Dipping his head, he drives his shoulder into the side of the van, making it rock violently on rusty springs.
Come out, you coward!
Stay here, I say to Evie, before sprinting across the road and down the path. Dougal Sheehan has picked up a shovel and is trying to smash the back window of the caravan. He succeeds on his third attempt, sending glass exploding inwards. Stepping to the right, he starts on another window.
Did you touch her?
He bellows.
Was it you?
Aidan is trapped inside, calling for help. Felicity Whittaker appears from inside the house, wearing a dressing gown and slippers. She throws herself at Dougal, grabbing at his arms, trying to wrestle the shovel from his hands. He pushes her away, sending her sprawling onto the grass. Up again, she hammers her fists on his back, yelling at him to leave Aidan alone.
It was Brian,
she sobs, breaking down.
It was Brian.
Dougal hurls the shovel at the caravan.
It bounces off the door, leaving a dent in the aluminium.
I promise you, please don't blame Aidan.
Felicity has pulled him down to his knees, where she cradles his head against her chest, like a mother comforting a hurt child. Dougal wants to argue, but she points a finger to his lips, saying,
Leave it be. It's better that way.
Another voice. Tasmin is standing on the patio in her pyjamas.
Mummy, is everything all right?
Go back to bed,
says Felicity, wiping her cheeks. She notices me for the first time. There is a beat of silence, and a sharp light enters her eyes.
What are you doing here?
She says, accusingly.
Have you been spying on us?
No. Dougal has climbed to his feet.
Did you follow me?
I was tracing Jodie's last movements.
Felicity's voice has changed to a harsh whisper.
You're trespassing.
I glance at Dougal, hoping for an explanation.
What has Aidan done?
Get off this property!
Yells Felicity.
Leave my family alone!
Her face is twisted in fury, and her fists are tightly bunched. She is half Dougal's size, but I fear her more because she doesn't seem rational. Behind her, the caravan door bursts open, and Aidan leaps from inside, almost spinning his legs in midair before he lands on the grass and takes off, sprinting down the side path and out onto the road, past the black cab and Evie Cormac. A small, dark knapsack bounces loosely on his back. Felicity yells for him to stop.
It's all right, love! You've done nothing wrong!
Dougal tries to take off in pursuit, but Felicity pulls him back, begging him to stop. The big man can't hope to catch Aidan, who is gone by the time I reach the road.
He went that way,
says Evie, pointing towards Silverdale Walk. I listen, and imagine I can still hear his footsteps on the asphalt path, crossing the bridge and skirting the meadow. But the only sound is Felicity tearfully calling his name, telling him to come home. Chapter 59. Angel Face.
I fall into step beside Cyrus as we walk along the footpath as far as the footbridge and glance over the railing at the pond. Why did Jodie come this way? I ask.
It's the shortest route home.
Silently, I mouth the word home. It should be a simple concept, but I've never understood what it means. Is home a place? Or a language, or a culture, or a climate, or geography. People run away from home and get homesick and become homeless. Does home mean something different to each person? Do we make our own? Does it make us whole? I wipe my nose on my sleeve. Why did that boy run?
I don't know.
He looked frightened.
Yes.
Cyrus pauses and raises his face to the treetops, as though sniffing something on the breeze. Without warning, he turns off the path. Where are we going?
There's a place just beyond those trees, an old hunting lodge. I want to check it out.
He takes my hand, leading me along a muddy path that narrows in places and is soft beneath my boots. A cobweb brushes and breaks against my cheek. Faint night sounds are audible between our footsteps. I can see the building now. The roof has partially collapsed, like a house of cards that has fallen on one side, and vines have grown up into the rafters, trying to wrestle the remaining walls to the ground.
Wait here,
he says.
Don't go.
Do you have your phone?
I nod.
If I'm not back in 15 minutes, I want you to call the police.
10 minutes.
Okay.
I lose sight of his silhouette in the deeper shadows, but hear the creak of weight being placed on wooden steps. I hear his voice.
Aidan?
But no reply. The trees lean towards me, closing over my head, blacker than the sky, although some are edged by faint traces of silver from cobwebs and beads of dew. I'm used to understanding night sounds, Not the insects or the birds, but the creak of floorboards and the groan of branches and someone breathing in the darkness. Time passes. I look at my phone. The brightness of the screen blinds me for a few seconds. I don't know how many minutes have passed. I didn't make a note of the time when Cyrus left. It must be 10 by now. Longer. I softly call his name. Louder. Don't leave me, I want to say. Is he playing a game? Is he hiding? Is he hurt? Moments later, I hear voices. Cyrus appears. The boy is with him. Aiden keeps his eyes down, not acknowledging me. His hair is uncombed and wild. He scuffs his shoes in the fallen leaves.
This is Evie, says Cyrus.
No hands are shaken. No looks are exchanged.
Can we go home now? I ask.
Yeah.
After midnight, the kettle is cooling. Tea has brewed. Aiden is sitting at the table with his bag between his feet, occasionally running his hands through his hair. He looks like a girl, I think. Prettier than most. Prettier than me. Cyrus asks him if he's hungry. A shake of the head.
Do you have any cigarettes?
I offer him one of mine from the packet I keep in the laundry, on a shelf above the dryer. Poppy lifts her head from the oversized wicker basket that has become her bed. We'll have to smoke in the garden, I say. Cyrus has a thing about secondhand smoke.
I'll make an exception for tonight,
Cyrus says. I give him a raised eyebrow.
Maybe you should go to bed, Evie.
I'm fine.
He jerks his head towards the door, but I reach for a cigarette and light up, positioning an ashtray between Aiden and me. Cyrus opens a window, settles again.
What was all that about? The fight with your uncle?
Aiden shrugs, eyes down, faltering. Cyrus tries again.
Jodie came to your house on the night she died. I think she knocked on the door of the caravan.
Aiden doesn't have to say anything. He's an open book. He's a whole library of open books.
How long had you two been...
5 months?
Says Aiden, filling his lungs with smoke.
Who knew?
Nobody.
Are you sure?
Aiden is staring at his reflection in the window.
We couldn't tell anyone. Aunt Maggie would have freaked out. She's so Catholic, you know. Jodie and me have known each other since we were kids. Most of that time, I thought she was just another annoying brat like Tasmin. But then...
He stops and starts again.
Tasmin had a sleepover party for her 16th birthday. It was all girls, dressed in pyjamas, playing games and dancing around the house to crappy pop songs. They were sneaking vodka into their lemonade. I was supposed to be the responsible adult, but I let it go, you know? I paid for the pizzas and then made myself scarce, hanging out in my van. Tasmin wanted to play hide and seek. I could hear the girls finding hiding places in the garden and upstairs. Next thing, Jodie burst into the caravan and pleaded with me to hide her. I told her to find somewhere else. I mean, you've seen my van. There are no hidey holes or crawl spaces. She could hear Tasmin counting, calling out, "Ready or not?" Jodie burrowed under the duvet next to me and lay still with her head on my chest, and her arms and legs wrapped around me.
Aiden looks up at Cyrus imploringly.
I know what you're thinking, but it wasn't like that. Up until that night, Jodie was just Jodie, you know? We grew up together. We splashed in wading pools and played Monopoly and wrestled for the TV remote. She was my cousin, not even a girl. But now she was wrapped around me, her head on my chest. I could feel her warm breath and smell her shampoo. Tasman came bursting through the door, asking if I'd seen Jodie. I told her no. She left. Jodie didn't move. For minutes she lay there, holding me, her face invisible, her body warm. Eventually she pushed back the duvet and looked up at me. Her eyes were shining. We'd never kissed before, not even on the cheek. But this was a proper kiss. An on-screen kiss, you know, like in the movies. She had a wad of chewing gum in her mouth. It finished in mine. It felt like we were trying to breathe for each other.
Did you have sex that night?
Not then. Later.
Was Jodie a virgin?
He nods.
Did you know she was pregnant?
Uh-huh.
Cyrus glances at me, wordlessly asking the question.